Hi, this is Mike Shea from SlyFlourish.com and a contributor to Critical Hits. I had an opportunity to talk to Dave the Game Chalker tonight about his recent completion of a Paragon tier D&D game. What you're about to hear is a recording between the two of us discussing tips for running a Paragon tier game and discussing tips in general for running Dungeons & Dragons. I hope you enjoy it.
So the reason I wanted to do this is because you just recently finished the Paragon tier of your home campaign, is that right?
Yep.
And I thought it would be kind of interesting to talk to you and get your perceptions of how the Paragon tier ran and give people some ideas and some tips about how what they should expect going into Paragon, or if they're in Paragon now, you know, how they can run it better from here on out. So to start with, if you can give a 3-minute description of your campaign, how did it get into Paragon and what happened while they were in Paragon?
Okay. Well, we did start all the way back, I think like the week after fourth edition was released, at first level as a regular game. And, without getting into my heroic tier stuff too much, you know, there was something resembling a finale and I had originally thought, oh, I'm going to do very disconnected heroic Paragon epic tier arcs. But as I finished up heroic tier, there's still a lot of plot threads out there. And I didn't want to just let those drop or kind of shoehorn them into like a bigger idea. I decided to extend a lot of those heroic tier through Paragon. And that sort of formed the foundation. That combined with getting kind of an influx of new players, you know, each of whom had their own character backstories that I could work with, into a whole new arc, you could say, that was both a continuation and felt like something new, you know. Mm-hmm. And plot-wise, it was originally they were working with this organization called the Inquisition through this big empire. Basically said, there's these prophecies, we want you to stop them because the last one's very bad, and you guys are kind of expendable, but if you succeed, we'll give you basically one favor, you know, and they're a very powerful organization, you know, and everyone had given me a favor. By the time they got to Paragon, though, the scrolls kind of took a back seat, and they had a bunch of leftover things to deal with, and that formed the arc as the chain god, the Ruzadun, emerges the big overall big bad guy with a number of smaller threats in between. So, like, basically messing with his people was one of the quest lines. I should also say, Paragon's when I started my 5x5 campaign arc. Okay. And so there were basically five plots starting it off, where one of them was, you know, investigate and mess with the chain god. One of them was stuff with the empire that they were working for. Like, there was an election and a bad guy that they had dealt with before was getting involved with that. Recover the scrolls was another one. And this is going back over a year now.
So right, sure.
That's why I'm struggling. I almost wouldn't pull up my own notes. But, I mean, basically there were a number of, you know, major threats. And a number of them that had to deal with, you know, the characters' backstories.
Right. Did you take them to any other worlds? Or were they... So, first of all, what game world was this in? Was it your own? Was it one of the published campaign worlds? Or
neither, really, oddly enough. Because it was doing this thing with Bartonius where, you know, his campaign world is the future for his game and mine was the past. Mm-hmm. And so he gave me a map to start out with and I kind of populated that, you know, with what all those meant. Mm. And then we, you know, worked to make sure they connected reasonably well, you know.
So he kind of built the whole world out himself and then gave you the history part of it to fill out?
Yep.
Cool.
That's basically it. Yeah, he gave me a map because that's one of the things I actually really dislike doing, coming up with maps and countries and stuff. And, you know, I just sort of said, okay, well, this is what this thing is, you know. And, like, it was also for most of the time a player in his game. So I knew, like, what these countries would end up being so I could kind of take inspiration from that.
Right. Did they go to any of the outer planes? Did you take them to Shadowfell or Feywild or anything like that? Or did they stick pretty much in a mortal world?
They went to other planes, but it tended to be sort of a one-off deal.
Quick
It pretty
jump.
much did the tour as overall. I mean, there was one adventure where they crossed over into the Shadowfell from a weak point. It was actually one of the kind of minor plot threads was that one of the big things in the game was that we used literal points of light, where that there was this magical metal that was placed in cities to keep out monsters, you know, and so the wilderness actually was much more dangerous than the cities, which were largely protected. But they found out that this magical substance had all these drawbacks and was causing dimensional tears and that kind of thing. So it gave me an excuse to easily say, like, okay, well, there's a tear here that goes into the Shadowfell. They had to reestablish the connection to the Feywild, which is another one. So they popped in the Feywild for a few adventures. I threw them into the Far Realm at one point,
Oh,
which was,
really?
yeah, and it was one of those things where,
Did they explode?
yeah, well, I almost killed them all. That was kind of fun. But I generally hate the type of adventure where the players just wake up and they don't remember how they got there. But for the Far Realm, it just made a lot of sense to me. So I did it where, like, they sort of woke up in medias res, like, okay, you wake up and there's, you know, you're in this kind of otherworldly prison, this weird stuff's going on, there's people there who shouldn't be there, that kind of thing.
So, if kind of getting to the bottom line up front, what are the three things you would tell somebody just going into the Paragon tier that they should be doing or paying attention to or not doing that you learned from your game and that they might not expect?
There's a couple things, I guess, on different levels, right? So there's kind of rules wise, if we're talking about,
All of it. Yeah, story, rules, whatever.
So rules wise, I definitely got to the point where the players were far outstripping existing published monsters, but a lot of that had to do with, you know, there's like pre-Monster Manual 3 design and Monster Manual 3 and after, and it's like a noticeable difference. So I got to the point where I knew that in order to challenge players or challenge players slash characters, that I really have to throw, like, you know, monster, you know, party level plus four monsters, like, across the board in order to have some kind of challenge. And I'd have to tweak those monsters no matter what, generally on the fly. Or I'd have to make my own monsters. And had Monster Manual 3 not changed things, I would have had to have designed monsters for pretty much every single thing, which I did not want to do. So power level kind of escalates.
Yeah, that damage, the damage scaling, like it doesn't, you know, the increase in damage for Monster Manual 3 creatures and beyond is a curve and throughout heroic it's not that extreme, but as soon as you get to Paragon into Epic, that curve is, the delta between that curve is really high.
And I generally my rule of monsters in D&D 4E is that I never feel bad about removing hit points or adding damage. And that really came into it where it's like, this guy is being way too gimpy, you know,
So you just
or
on the fly you'll just add damage or
yeah,
throw
pretty
him into
much.
overdrive mode as soon as he's bloodied.
Or he'd come up with another attack. It's also like I wouldn't be afraid to add monster powers or add effects that I felt made sense or swap for ones that I didn't find fun. So that's another thing, I guess another big tip is that part of the design is that you'll see more dazed, stunned, and dominated effects the higher level you get. And I just don't find those fun for anybody, you
You
know?
mean for putting on players too?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, on the monsters, you know, that can be kind of fun. Depending, I mean, you know, solos and stuff, you know, there's a reason that they started building in all those, you know, things to do about that. But as far as monsters on players go, yeah, there's a lot more that will toss those conditions out, and you'll find monsters that like can do all three just about every round.
Yeah, I don't know the new mechanic for dragons that they have in the Monster Vault, where they have a free action attack on 10 plus their initiative.
Yep.
And that they can either get that free attack or they can use it to remove
Shake
a disabling stun. That I ran that last night for the first time for a 26 level Black Dragon,
mm-hmm.
and it made a huge difference. And actually, the players really liked it. They thought like it was nice. They kept wanting to throw status effects on him just so he would remove them so they wouldn't get bit.
Yeah,
and,
exactly.
And that worked really well.
Yeah, I like really the design of those a lot. And
took them 2.5 years, but they got there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was like a clear difference, you know, like here was monsters, here were dragons that were previously designed, you know, and they were gimpy selves, and then here's like a new badass dragon.
Right. So that's kind of two tips. Do you have a third?
The third tip, I guess this sort of goes in your question about, you know, were they world hopping?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you don't necessarily need to do things like throw them into other planes all the time or, you know, have the gods come down and, you know, regularly in Paragon.
Right.
I thought it worked really well, just as sort of a natural extension. Like, here's the things you were doing in Heroic or kind of locally.
Right.
And you just start making the scope of everything, you know.
Scale it up.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, instead of saying, okay, there's, you know, like 5 bad things going on within a day's travel, mm-hmm. you know, it's like, okay, now you've got a continent to play with,
mm-hmm.
you know, and letting them manage jumping around all over the place and, you know, the scale of things. You know, it doesn't, like, they don't all have to be world-shattering stuff either, you know.
Right. Did you give your guys a home base? And was that home base different in Paragon than it was in Heroic?
Yep. They've had several home bases now. In Heroic, they were sort of based out of a tavern in the main city,
mm-hmm.
just as somewhere to collectively group back in.
Mm-hmm.
And then in Paragon, I actually gave them one of the dungeons from Thunderspire Labyrinth
mm-hmm.
that they had cleared out, and then they sort of came back to them and were like, oh, this place was kind of cool, and, you know, set that up as a base.
That's cool.
Yeah.
It's funny. I wonder how many campaigns have a place in Thunderspire Labyrinth that turned into a headquarters, because... I mean, my whole campaign was built around a bar that was in the Seven Pillared Hall.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, for the first 20 levels. They got a new one in Sigil at level 21 to 30, but
mm-hmm.
In fact, they built a permanent portal between the two, and it created this great economic vacuum where they got rich really quickly because gear and stuff that they found in Sigil was never available anywhere in the Seven Pillared Hall, and now it was.
Right, right. Extra dimensional traders.
Yeah, right.
It's kind of cool.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, that adventure is filled with a cool setting.
Yeah, it's
anyway.
A really good one. It's a really good adventure.
That the villain from that also ended up being kind of a campaign villain, too.
Yeah, yeah. I ended up blowing him off. I didn't do him right. I didn't do him a lot of service because he was a Vecna-based guy, and I was very heavily into Orcus.
Right.
So I kind of was like, he's just this guy, and he's kind of doing some stuff. And they went and they killed him, and that was fine.
Right.
Calorel ended up being an enemy of my guys for 18 levels. You know,
which makes sense because he was also an Orcus guy.
Yeah, right. And he was a big Orcus priest. And I just, it was one of those where I lucked out and he just became a great villain right early on, right at level one. They really didn't like him. And he was this like crazy serial killer, you know, kind of guy. And it was a lot of CSI kind of stuff. And it was a lot of fun.
That's pretty cool. Yeah. I feel like that illustrates another really good point. Where, you know, Paldemar from Thunderspire Labyrinth, like, he was just the villain of that module, and, you know, there's not a lot of setup for him in that module anyway.
Right.
But it just so happened by circumstance in the game that he escaped, you mm-hmm. know.
Yeah.
Like, my party stopped him, but he got away.
Mm-hmm.
And then he was sort of this dangling piece that I was able to draw from later right. on, you know, especially right. when I was planning Paragon. I was like, okay, who are all the villains still out there? Oh, I can use him, and what's he up to? He's doing these things, you right. know.
He became greater than the stat block he had in that book.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
It
happened
like
on its own.
When you're planning that kind of thing, you know, instead of just trying to come up, okay, we're a Paragon tier, I'm going to make all new bad guys across the board
mm-hmm.
and think, okay, what didn't I use before that would be cool to bring back and,
right.
you know, develop it from there.
Right, right. Yeah, I did the exact same thing with Calorel. He was level 19 or something when they faced him again.
Mm-hmm.
And it was
yeah, the bad guys level up too is a big thing.
Yeah, right, right. Wait, he leveled up a really bad way. He was sent to the Abyss and Orcus didn't treat him very well, but when he came out, he was a lot stronger.
Sounds like an Orcus thing to do.
Yeah, right, right. He's going to bathe his guys in blood.
Mm-hmm.
So What did you find most fun about Paragon? Like, what excited you about Paragon, and what ended up being really enjoyable compared to, like, Heroic?
I really felt like it was the time when characters came into their own. Mm-hmm. Because at lower levels, both mechanically and story-wise, there's only so much they can do. You know, they only have a few options in combat generally before Paragon, mm-hmm. and that starts taking off. You know, they start to be, you know, more respected. They start to get more synergies going within their own stuff, and their storylines can really get a chance to mature, where it's not just more of like a fight for survival or find their footing in the game itself.
Right.
That's, you know, they're part of a larger world, and they are making a difference on an individual character basis.
Right.
Which you could argue, because I like kind of fast leveling up in my games, because mm-hmm. That's what I enjoy as a player too. That's, you know, if you run like a slower game where they're gaining fewer levels, you know, per session.
Right.
Like, you could probably get that kind of same effect, but it really does feel like, you know, when they're gaining levels at a decent pace while they're getting more important story-wise, it really does feel like, you know, these guys really are movers and shakers for a reason, you know?
Right. How did you do leveling up?
For a long time, I used XP and fudged a lot of it. It was like, oh, well, that seemed like a big quest. Here's a bunch more XP on top of that.
Right.
Better get to the level. And then I was like, this is stupid. Nobody ever...
Nobody cares.
Yeah, well, I mean, we're so used to it, you know, because most of the people in my gaming group I gamed with back in middle school and high school, you know?
Right.
Like, we've been gaming together for a long time, right. And that was the way it was done.
Sure.
And I totally remember, you know, like, oh, I killed a monster. How much XP do I get? But, like, now, you know, so many of them are, like, busy professionals with families and whatnot.
Just tell me when I leveled.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, they didn't want to track individual numbers. Like, people would hear different amounts.
Right.
You know, and I tried to put a lot of it on the wiki, but, like, they wouldn't always check the wiki for the game.
So I loved your interview, by the way, with what's the fellow's name who ran...
With Micah?
Yeah, who ran Obsidian Portal. Mm-hmm. And he said, like, don't, you know, whatever you write there, don't assume they're going to read it.
Yeah, you know, they sure won't.
That was great.
I had that lesson hammered and did my Paragon finale. But
I guess I never cared. I mean, I have a 30th level campaign up there, a 30 level campaign written up there, and I think it's been read like 4 times, but whatever. Right. I like it.
Yeah, it's tough when you expect a certain level of investment and the players don't return that, though. When you have some people who are like, oh, I really want to know what happened, you know, and I'm like, well, I wrote it up, but, you know, and then you have people who haven't read it and they're just confused and like, yep. Who the heck's that, you know?
Yeah, right. Particularly, do you have kind of a mix of people like that in your group? Do you have some people who are really into it and spending a lot of time on it, and some that are kind of just, look, man, tell me when to roll my 20s?
Yeah, it's a solid mix. I mean, everyone, I feel, is decently invested in the campaign as a whole.
Right.
But there's still people who, like, the game, you know, starts and ends at the table. Like, there's, even scheduling them can sometimes be a tough thing, because, you know, it's like that is this other, you know, microcosm that doesn't affect the rest of their lives, where other people, you know, I'll chat with around the week what happened, that kind of thing,
or
they'll read write-ups and whatnot.
Yeah, I found that I followed the same model that they used for the game Portal, where they just kept asking people periodically through the game, okay, what's going on now, and who's the villain, and what are you doing? And they'd be like, I don't know. And then they'd go back and edit the hell out of what they were doing until they get it down to like Orcus is the bad guy.
Orcus bad. We kill him.
Orcus bad. He's on the cover of the Monster Manual. Like, so, you know, that it and I didn't find it. I mean, I kind of like thin games anyway. You know, I don't really want a lot. I mean, I had a fair bit of detail, but I didn't have a lot of twists and turns and a lot of crazy plot stuff. You know, I tried to keep it really basic, which is, you know, Orcus is trying to destroy the universe and you don't know why and you need to stop him from doing so. And
yeah.
I think it helps to have a campaign that can be summarized. You can have as much detail as you want, as long as everybody's at least got that core concept they're able to run at the game.
Right. Well, I also feel like the 5x5 method really helped a lot for my game.
Yeah.
Because, you know, in Heroic, it was a bit easier to lose track of kind of where they were.
Right.
Whereas I tried, although I wasn't always very good at it, it was like, here are the 5 quests that are going on. You know, here's the ultimate goal for each one, and here's where you stand in each one. Mm-hmm. So here are your options. You know, what do you want to pursue? Mm-hmm.
How much, how sandboxy? I mean, so that's a stupid question. You're just talking about the 5x5, but when you're, you know, what are the practical ramifications of like the 5x5 method at the table? You know, my big hardship is I want to give people a lot of freedom to make choices and go different directions, but I also have to have stuff planned for the game. And,
right.
And like, you know, like they're not reading Obsidian Portal. When I try to do stuff outside of the game, like an email, I get like one person who responds.
Yeah.
So how do you give people freedom to choose, but still know where you're going to go next week?
That, I mean, I think you hit it right on the head, the difficulty. But what I would usually do is say, you know, okay, when we're scheduling the next game, here are the five, you know, which one are you interested in? And yeah, you won't get all that many responses, mm-hmm. but you can just say, you know, I'm just going with whichever one I heard the most of, you know, even if that player like didn't show up to the table, I'm like, this is what I planned. You know,
Bob chose.
Like, you know, this character might have browbeat you into doing this mission before, and now you're doing, you know,
right.
So it's a little, I mean, it's kind of like it's railroady once they're at the table, mm-hmm. but, before that, it's like here are different options. And if people would occasionally say like, well, there was still this thing I kind of wanted to pursue, I could tailor it to that.
Right.
As long as they let me know before the game that they were sort of vaguely interested, even if they narrowed it down to like two things, mm-hmm. you know, I can make those things dovetail in any way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think that the trick I found from it, and I think you and I talked about this before, is, you know, making sure that I know what the choice is going to be at the end of the game, and then they cannot leave the house until they've made that choice.
I'll
stick the dog on them.
Right.
If they don't pick one of the three or one of the four, or one of the five paths, and, mm-hmm. and they generally will. There's a lot of kind of like looking back and forth at each other and looking at me, and I make sure that I have no heart in any one of those particular choices. Like I don't want to say like, oh, I'd really wish you'd go after the assassin, or I really wish you'd go find that ring because that's really cool and these other ones kind of suck. You know, I try to make sure that I either don't plan any of them any more than the other ones, or they're all planned equally. And usually it's the former because I don't want to do a lot of work.
Right.
Did you find any, how did you find the pace of battle? Did it change between heroic and paragon? You have a lot of players at your table. You did. Is that right?
Well, that was another big change at Paragon, where with there being a lot more players joining the campaign, I split them up mm-hmm. into two groups after a few, not that many adventures, I think, maybe like four or five, where I had one of those absolutely horrendous, like, eight-player games that took forever, and, like, there was arguing. Like, there's, man, I've never liked big group D&D games in any edition.
Right.
And generally any role-playing game, mm-hmm. you know, I'm not a fan. I just had one of those sessions where it exemplified every single possible problem where, like, people were making noise on one side, so the other people on the other side could hear.
A guy dragged Dance Dance Revolution out in the middle of it, and he's doing that.
And, you know, it's like, oh, it's an hour between each of my turns.
Right.
And the thing that really syncs an adventure with a lot of players is that, like, you give them any kind of choice, and just because of the weight of how many people there are, you will have two groups, each rooting for different sides.
Yeah.
So you just, you know, the game grinds to a halt because you have critical mass on both sides, like, diametrically opposed to, like, what do we do next, you know?
It's like a jury.
Yeah, exactly. Huh. There's, like, no consensus that you can...
So what'd you end up doing? You split them into two groups?
Yeah, so I started running roughly every week instead of every other week, although it was subject to, you know, to show up and stuff. And then if people, like, were at one game, people who weren't at that game would have precedence for the next one. But there ended up being, say, like, two to three fairly regular players, and then, you know, the other slots would be filled by more of a rotating cast, you could say.
Right. And that worked out pretty well?
Yeah, I'd say it worked out pretty well. You lose some things that a consistent game group has. You know, it's a little more difficult to keep track of the story and mm-hmm. characters and stuff. Like, oh, was I there for that adventure? You know, like, I don't remember meeting that guy, et cetera, et cetera.
So once you got to more manageable group size, did you find the pace of battles in Paragon any different than the pace of battles in Heroic?
Yeah, it depended. Again, I I feel like, you know, once Monster Manual 3 was out, you know, things changed dramatically. And I, it was also partially, there was a point in Paragon where I felt like as a DM, I hit my stride.
Yeah, right.
Where I wasn't just saying, well, like, I got the instincts to be able to say, you know, this battle should be cut, or
right.
I need to include more options for ending every combat.
Right, the out.
The outs,
the famous,
yeah.
The famous Dave the Game out.
Exactly. Okay. I mean, this is where I came from, just yeah. the crucible of running Paragon.
Right, right.
Where it's like, there's no reason this fight should be to the death, like the, you know, or I would get the sense like they would concentrate on the big bad guy who had raised all these other things. And I'm like, you know what? They expect him to kill off all the other things that he summoned. Why not just make that happen? You know,
right.
Done the damage I wanted to do, you know?
Right. Yeah. I can't think of a non-boss battle where it went the full length.
Yeah.
You know, like, I think almost every battle I've had, you know, the skeletons break into pieces and fall to the ground, or the guy runs away, or the robots, you know, if it's dark, you know, Gamma World, the robots all stop working when the mastermind is down. And the funny thing is, I keep expecting players to get mad because they've been, like, beating the hell out of the Iron Golem, you know, and they've got him down to, you know, from 450 hit points to 100, and then they kill the wizard, and then the golem disappears. Like, why did we beat him up for 350 hit points, you know? But they never seem to get mad, so.
Yeah.
I guess they're all ready to, for the battle to be done, too, and they're not about to complain.
I think that's the thing, especially when you're with a group for that long. Like, you all get roughly on the same page about that kind of thing.
Right, right.
Where it's like, yes, they, you know, they did some satisfying things to kill the monsters, but it's time for this to end.
And it helps considerably to have that planned ahead. Like, if you know, if you can kind of, or at least have a few different options prepared, because if not, it looks really artificial if you just kind of end the battle. And I've seen DMs at, like, LFR and stuff like that where they go, okay, we're going to call the battle here. And you're like, what is that? Like,
yeah.
That's the lamest conclusion to a fight. Just, I'm bored, and we're going to move on. And you're like, but what do we just, you know? And it's usually right when we're about to, like, wipe out everybody that's still left. And, you know, I've got my big hits left and all this stuff, and they just call it. It's lame.
Yeah, anything with a timetable, unfortunately, can lead to that sort of thing where I've had, you know, home games that are like, you know, I'd like to play out more in this battle, but we're out of time, you know, like,
yeah, that's
one player has to go to a wedding. We have to stop. You know?
Yeah. The other thing you mentioned, which I think is a really good point, worth reinforcing is, yeah, I found that, you know, just like you, I kind of hit my stride as I was getting through Paragon. I think Paragon is demanding enough that you have to start, you know, getting some really good time management tips at the table. You know, you're ability to get players moving and ability to move the battle along hits a certain level. All of the tools that you have, all of the little tricks that you have really refined if you've played all the way through Heroic.
Yep, exactly.
And that continues through Epic. I think Epic actually, the only thing with Epic, and we'll talk more about what you're thinking about as you move into Epic, but the thing I've seen at Epic is it's even more so in it, that drive to try to, you know, make sure that you're threatening players is even harder, but you've kind of built the tools up in Paragon, and I think the tools are a lot better now too with Monster Vault and Monster Manual 3 and stuff like that.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the other thing is that, like, Heroic tier, you kind of feel like filler battles are more expected, like, you know, oh, there's orcs in this next room, and like that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And as you get farther into Paragon, it's like each battle should matter more, both in terms of, like, the threats and the story, you know?
Right, right. Yeah, I had a lot of hard time with that because I wanted, particularly, I noticed it the most in the end of my Epic game where I wanted to get through, like, a big dungeon in two nights, and I really didn't want to spend a lot of time in there, mainly because I had people that were going to be, I knew they were going to be out, like, in a month.
Sure.
And I wanted to finish the whole campaign, and I had it down to, like, four nights left. But I wanted to have side battles, and there was no real good way. I came up with a couple of ways to kind of have side battles that took not a lot of time, but it was really hard to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, in Heroic, you can have a little bit of faster battles that aren't a big deal. But in Paragon and Epic, I think because the players have so many options, you know, no matter what you throw on the table, it's still going to take an hour.
Ram.
Which is a tough one. What did you see any changes in your players' behavior as you went into Paragon, both mechanically and story-wise?
They picked up a lot more about, you know, how their powers worked and how other people in the party's powers worked roughly. You know, they're still with leveling, and I was pretty liberal about retraining and that kind of thing. You know, they were still always like, oh, you can do that now, or, you know, unleash that thing you unleashed last week. Oh, no, I don't have that anymore, you know.
Right. How about story wise? Did they kind of get into the story? Did they start to feel like they were the big shots walking around rather than, you know, the local mercenaries that you could hire at the bar?
Yeah, well, there's more stuff in the game by necessity that specifically talk to their characters, you know, that involve their character backstories. And like, this is an adventure focused on this person, you know, so they know that that's important that they're there and that kind of thing.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty much it. You know, there tended to be more involvement with those characters, which, you know, is good for me as a DM, but also, you know, I hope that they liked when it was like, oh, here's a spotlight adventure on you, you know.
Did you have a few of those, the spotlight adventures?
Had a bunch, yeah. Even spotlight kind of mini arcs, that kind of thing,
How do
you
you
know.
handle, how did you handle side quests? I mean, I always had a hard time because, you know, I have this main storyline that I want to keep moving forward, but, you know, sometimes the player would be like, oh, I'd kind of like to figure out how I could be part of a thieves guild. And
Right.
I never felt right, like, dragging the other five players over to go work on him being a thief, you know, being part of the thieves guild. How did you handle that?
Well, to an extent, because there were five quests, you know, kind of everything was a side quest in a way.
Right. Oh, yeah.
At the same time, I guess I didn't have people come to me and say, oh, I want to join the Thieves Guild. They would have something more in their backstory, like, here's my ultimate goal. And I would make sure that that would tie in, you know, that would weave into these other plots. So they were kind of accomplishing multiple things at a time, where it's like, yes, you know, this character is freeing his homeland from the giants. You know, that's not just because this character cares about his homeland. It's like everyone knows, like, oh, that's actually kind of an important thing for everyone.
Right. Did you find any other mechanical differences going from heroic to paragon? Things like environmental effects, and in particular, were there, did you change how you ran or how you thought about skill challenges when you went into paragon?
Not really. I still use skill challenges roughly the same way that, you know, depending on their importance in an adventure, I would use them, you know, I would develop them more or less. Like, there would be some impromptu ones that pretty much operated the same way. Whereas if one would be the centerpiece of the adventure, I'd make sure to have that really statted out beforehand.
Say hello to the kitty.
Yes, that one's here.
What do you find most like? What are? I mean, do you like skill challenges? Do they work well for you and your group?
It's. I feel like they're this big box that, you know, there are any number of things that, you know, there are some that are good, some that are bad, some that I ran well, some that I didn't. Some players who respond to them more than others, you know. I really am convinced that, like, the implementation that's put forward in the books doesn't really work. And the most satisfying ones for me have been the ones that, again, they kind of define an adventure and almost felt like, I don't want to say a mini game by themselves, but they had their own particular quirks to them in their design than the ones that were like, you know, chase the bad guy down the streets, impromptu sort of ones. Like, you know, those tended to run really quick. You know, you just go around the table and then see what happens. But like, it was much more satisfying. Like, the big, you know, the one I did that I posted on my blog, there was like an airship battle.
Yeah, right. I remember that.
Yeah, that one still stands out to me as, you know, the best for any number of reasons.
Yeah, I ran a similar one that was kind of an assault on a bar where the bar was run by some gangster and they were going to go in and wipe out the bar, and they really enjoyed that. And the other one was a defense of a town where a town was getting under attack by trolls. And, you know, I mean, it was like 15, 20 levels later, you know, 2 years after that occurred, they're still like, oh, I love that one where we had to move the boxes around and block off certain alleys so that we could filter all the trolls through that one alley. They really dug that.
Yeah,
And
exactly.
I was
And
never able to recreate it
I
again.
know, right? I mean, that's another thing where you feel like you hit your stride with them later. You know, you experiment with them a bit, and then, you know, you're like, oh, well, I know that works or that doesn't, at least.
Yeah, I mean, I'm slowly moving over to the conclusion that the less prep I do for a skill challenge, the better. You know, that like if you really want to let those things move and grow organically, you have to kind of just have a real loose like, what are you generally trying to do? what happens if they succeed, what happens if they fail, and, you know, leave it pretty open.
Mm-hmm.
And that tends to work a lot more. But I've got a few ideas for skill challenges I want to use in the future. So after how long did it take for you to get through Paragon?
Got to think about this for a second.
You have to check your Obsidian Portal site.
Yeah, that would actually tell me more definitively. I'm tempted to say it was around a year and a half.
Around a year and a half, yeah.
Yeah.
And that was every other week, or you switched every week?
Yeah, anywhere between bi-weekly and weekly.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm sorry, how fast did your players level? You said that you leveled pretty fast.
Yeah, once I went through that whole, hey, we're ditching XP thing, everyone's right. The same level. We level whenever I say so,
right.
Which was around 3 to 4 adventures.
Okay. Yeah.
Especially because, again, with like a changing player base every week,
mm-hmm.
I didn't want it to be too much like, oh, I show up one time and I show up
level
the next
every
time.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm 2 levels higher, you know.
So when you say 3 to 4 adventures, it's 3 to 4 adventures across both groups, right? Including both
Correct.
Groups. Okay.
Yep.
Yeah. So if it was just one group, it would be about every other one or so?
Yeah, probably.
Yeah.
Maybe, I mean, 3 seems like the right
two
number.
2 to 3, right.
Yeah.
That's almost exactly what my whole game ended up being, was every 2 to 3 levels, and that worked out pretty well.
Yeah, I also, like, I was often able to tie it to things in-game,
right.
You know, major quests completed and that kind of thing.
Right. Yeah, I stuck to, you know, everybody else seemed to ditch experience points, and my group was perfectly happy. You know, even my most mathematically inclined players were like, just tell us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, why do you keep throwing numbers at us, and we keep
right.
pretending to write them down, and then you say it. And I was religious about I wasn't accurate about it. I didn't count up all the monsters and figure out exactly how many minions there were and figure out how many, you know, experience per minions.
Right.
But I still stuck to the numerical system, only because I wanted to give them another tangible reward on top of the other stuff that they were getting.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if they appreciated it or not, but I stuck with it. And it wasn't hard to do.
Right.
I mean, my solution for giving him experience basically came down to find the monster, you know, find a normal, non-solo, non-elite, non-minion monster that's of the level of the challenge that I saw, and
mm-hmm.
then award that to each of them, and it worked out perfectly.
Yeah.
And then I'd give them little bonus ones, and eventually they just level up when I wanted them to level up.
Yeah.
But I like them to have a tangible, you know, on top of the quest rewards, on top of the story rewards, on top of gear. They also have this other thing that they see moving forward as they're going through. But, you know, I don't know. But a lot of other people have left it behind, and nobody seems to care.
Yeah, I mean, I understand, you know, I've been a player enough times to know, like, getting a bunch of XP and, you know, at one adventure getting up more XP than another is very exciting and motivating. But at
sure.
the same time, you know, ultimately just being able to say, like, this is a big thing that you accomplished. I'm hoping that that's a tangible enough reward, you know. But
yeah, one of the coolest things that one of my players did is he set up a Google spreadsheet and
mm-hmm.
kept track of everything from the first adventure to the last. So
yeah.
I can actually see on exactly what night they went to what part of the, you know, what adventure, and exactly how much experience and gold and everything they got. And that was, yeah, I mean, he was just lucky that he had done it. I guess one guy started it on a big ratty sheet of paper that was covered with like brownie bits, but they eventually moved it to the digital spreadsheet. It's a nice record of the entire 3-year period.
Yeah, Danny does similar, but he tracks experience in his game for everybody. So
yeah, right.
And he does it all through Wiki.
Right.
But I mean, the thing that I really I got over in Paragon tier was, like, I really hated when people were on equal levels.
Yeah, I never did that. I always had everybody on an equal level. You know, I didn't care how many games you missed.
Yeah,
you'd just still be the same level as everybody else.
Yep.
So after running their Paragon game for as long as you did, what do you wish you had done differently when you were running it?
I mean, I really wish that, you know, I could just send myself an email to the past and be like, you know, here's what you need to do to monsters to make them effective, and here's what you need to do to your encounters to make them more efficient, you know, because I'm not going to say it's as bad as a lot of people make it out to be online,
mm-hmm.
and I have had plenty of fast combats, and
mm-hmm.
you know, I would say most combats run about the length that I want them to,
mm-hmm.
but there were enough slogs, you know, I could see why someone would get turned off,
right?
and I would just like never have those happen, you know?
Yeah, right. Yeah, I was yeah. I think that particularly again when I got into Epic, it was I love that talking to you about Paragon is really talking about Epic, but that heavy environmental effects made a big difference. You know, like I had a bunch of ghouls that were kind of normal ghouls and or whites or whatever, and the party's fighting the whites, and that was all fine, and they were real excited because they use these powers. Meanwhile, the room is filling up with blood, and the blood is this horrible necrotic blood, and it's increasing in how much damage it does every round by a 10. So, like by the fourth round, they're like, "We're taking 40 damage a piece," you know,
Well, that's
every
the
time we
thing.
start. We got to worry about the blood and not worry about the whites.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of my group, you know, fairly notorious for this, are very good min-maxers.
Yeah, right.
And so there are some characters that, you know, are almost impossible to challenge with monsters. So like the only way to really give them a challenge and to make them think and more make the game interesting for them is to throw in other stuff going on.
Yeah, right. Right.
And that works out for everybody, you know?
Yep. Particularly anytime you could just throw vast amounts of damage around.
Yeah, especially ones that don't have to roll a hit against.
Yeah. Auras. I'll tell you one that I used last night for the first time that was just awesome. And I used it on Orcus, but it worked really well on this guy. And they have it on a couple of Paragon monsters. It's particularly for the Black Dragon in the Monster Vault. Is whenever he gets hit, he does acid damage to everybody around him, and it's just, you know, I had a player just screaming, "Stop hitting him! Please, I'm gonna die." That was good to hear for a guy that was basically immortal, you know. So where are you headed with Epic?
We're
Are
still
you going into Epic? Are you planning to keep continuing your campaign?
yes, but we had some discussions about how much, I mean, it sort of ties into all the other things about story and significance of fights. Like, to me, I'm not interested in running, you know, 10 levels of Epic. Just trying to come up with, you know, that many encounters that make sense for Epic level characters. You know, like, oh, it's another week, we're fighting another set of demigods. You know, like, that doesn't appeal to me as a DM. You know, there's just not enough variety in story. So I've already set it up so they're going to do like a astral sea spell jamming thing in faraway plane where they're trying to recover the Rod of Seven Parts. And it's like it's connected to sort of an overall storyline. But Paragon was like, you know, this is the end of all the loose plot threads, you know, of the campaign basically in this world. So now you guys are going off world, far, far away, probably never to return. So, you know, that all's done. So we've already had a satisfying finale for that, I would say. So enough of that has happened that I'm happy with. So now it's kind of gravy at this point.
That's cool.
So either we're going to do something, I think my preferred thing right now would be to do like a power leveled set of Epic Games, do like 10 adventures, one leech, and then do some finale stuff at 30 and be done. Other people have talked about doing like a few adventures at one level, skipping a few levels, having the players sort of fill in what happened in the meantime, and you know, skip a few and you know, do it, which would be a few more adventures, but they wouldn't experience everything in between. There are other options, you know, but.
Yeah, that's going to be a little rough for, you know, for trying to find that right challenge. Because you have to learn. What I noticed was that I really had to learn the core capabilities of each of the characters as they progressed. So like the first time they faced a hero slaying Hydra, like a 26th level hero slaying Hydra, and they killed it in a round and a half because one guy had one power that gave everybody else a free attack every time anybody crit. And it, you know, if I didn't know that that power was going to be there, I mean, thank God it was on a guy that didn't matter. But if it was on a boss, you know, that'd be a pretty anticlimactic fight. Well, at least for me. Maybe they'd be like, "Yeah, you see that? You know, the big bad ghoul king dropped in one round."
Exactly. It doesn't
So
really have the epic feel you're hoping
doesn't
for.
have the feel. I want to have a little bit more challenge. But you have, you know, one thing I notice is, and I'm guessing that every DM that's running an epic game really has to tailor it around the types of players, the types of PCs that are going to be in it, and the types of players that are going to be in it.
Yeah,
And that can
well,
be rough if
I'm
you're
making a
skipping
few
levels.
changes, at least for sure. that might carry into my next campaign that would be starting over.
What are those?
Let's see. I'm mostly ditching magic items.
Oh, really? You're going to do the inherent bonuses?
Doing the inherent bonuses and giving people, like, two items that they can basically have at a time, plus maybe one kind of utility slots for, you know, something that has, like, a daily power you want to use but wouldn't come up every game, you know.
That's a cool idea.
Yeah, because magic items, they're not.
Yeah, they're ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, like, I've written whole rants on it, but it's not part of the game that appeals to me anymore, you know. Yeah,
two pages of yellow, you know, orange items. And like, oh, God.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I could just give out, like, one of the successes I had in Paragon was giving out artifacts, which I liked a lot.
Right.
And those kind of drove the story. If I can do more of that where I'm giving, you know, this is what rare items were supposed to pull.
Right.
Where it's like a character-defining item. You know, that's more interesting. I think it's more motivating than, well, we're due for a next slot, you know.
Sure. What else are you bringing forward?
For my finale, they were running around Temple of Elemental Evil, and I had little tracks that would advance, like, when they'd have a combat, when they'd take extended rest, and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it really added a lot to the game.
Hmm.
I mean, it's a little facetious, but I almost feel like I fixed 4E by doing that.
So explain that. How did that work?
The full write-up's in the blog.
Oh, okay. How did I miss it?
It was this week, so it might have been the reason.
Wow.
But anyway, there are, like, you know, basically bad things happening tracks, you know, different factions that advance, you know, when the players take an extended rest. So instead of the game being more episodic and there being a reset button, you know, they actually have to decide, okay, we're going to take an extended rest, and that's kind of a big deal.
Right.
And so it forces them to manage their dailies a bit more, to, like, I actually have a chance of draining people's healing surges, which, like, never happens, you know, in a one-off, like, extended rest after every game.
Right.
The defender's always going to have, you know, like, seven more. You know, it makes all that matter again. So I'm going to do something like that. But instead of it being confined to a dungeon, it will be the whole campaign, right?
Sure.
Those are the two big ones. I might do something with skills because they're fairly unsatisfying to me, which also would tie into the whole skill challenge thing. But I'm not sure about that yet.
Right. So with we only have a couple of minutes before you have to go.
Yep.
Is there any, like, last big tip that you'd give to somebody who's just about to head into Paragon? Any one thing you say you really want to pay attention to this? Is it the monster math and making sure to use current things? Is it scaling the story for big stuff?
Those are both pretty important, but I guess my big tip is don't be afraid to break the rules.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, 4E is a great tool set, but you shouldn't feel constrained by that. You know, like, I felt I was having the most fun when I was making monsters do more interesting things as, you know, befit the story that I was, you know, I was calling combats or doing interesting things in the environment based on what the monsters were and what the players were doing. I was giving out, you know, specialized boons, you know, that were kind of like magic items, but, you know, some of them were completely ridiculous, but, you know, it was okay, you know?
Right, like, sure.
So just don't be afraid, like, don't feel confined by the tool set to only use those tools, you know? Like, do what makes sense to you and what you think is going to be fun for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that's my big thing, you know, in Paragon, you should have a better idea of who the characters are and what your players are like, and so you can start adjusting things more so to how that goes, even if it has to be on the fly, and even if it means, like, you know, in my case, where the sword mage suddenly has an AC of 57, that you need to have a way for the sponsor to actually challenge him, you know?
did they really have an AC of 57?
Yeah.
Oh, man. So three rapid-fire questions. Do you tell them that they're minions?
Sometimes yes, sometimes no.
Do you tell them when they're about to go into a skill challenge?
Usually not.
And do you hide your dice rolls?
Yes.
Ah, excellent. Well, this is awesome, Dave.
Yeah, this was fun. Thanks.
I really enjoyed talking to you, and I think it'll be very useful for people that are going into Paragon, and good luck with Epic.
Yeah, thanks. I might be bugging you for advice, actually.
Absolutely. Well, yeah. I think I can help you there.
Yeah.
So good to talk to you.
Yep, you too.